can see the lights in the sky, and I know we're there. Got the tickets till they kick us out the county fair.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and that's County Fair by the country music band Rascal Flatts. And if you're not dancing, come on, you've got no heart. It's helping us get in the spirit of fair season. There are dozens of fairs in Vermont around harvest time, many of them agricultural in tradition, at least. Most of the county and regional fairs have at least a few things in common that fans return for again and again. Funnel cake, cotton candy, maple creamies, and, of course, tractor pulls. A few years ago, during our Fair People series, VPR visited the Orleans County Fair in Barton for the tractor pulling contest.
My name's Katie Haley, and I live in Orleans. I'm pulling this WD-45 Alice Charmos tractor. It's my father-in-law's tractor, and before I met my husband, I never had pulled tractors before, and it's just something that I got into through the family. This is my third time pulling. I have pulled this tractor the farthest out of anybody in the family. Yeah. It has a lot of work that needs to be done. The motor actually needs to be redone because it doesn't have a lot of compression, but we're still here just because the rest of the family's here, and it's just something that they've always done together.
The first lady of the day to pull, and this is Katie Haley from Orleans, driving the 1952 Alice Chalmers WD-45. Katie Haley, and Katie is the final one in this class. Good pull, Katie. How about a good hand? Katie Haley right here, Alice Chalmers WD-45.
Katie Haley finished 9th out of 13 competitors that year in her class. We're going to talk more about fairs today, and we want to hear what you love about them. Do you go back year after year? Is the fair something that you look forward to? And what's your favorite part? Is it the maple cotton candy? Is it seeing all of the kids doing their 4-H projects? What is it about the fairs that's special to you? You can tell us your favorite story over at vpr.net. Click on Vermont Edition. Or call us, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you are actually over at the Addison County Fair and Field Days today. That fair in full swing right now. And let's talk with Jim Foster. He's president of the Addison County Fair and Field Days. Hi, Jim. Nice to talk with you.
Hey, Jane. Good talking with you today. Beautiful day out here.
Yeah, where are you right now?
I am down just opposite the antique barn, as well as at the end of the tractor pad, just kind of in the midst of it all.
And are people there having a good time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got a great crowd going here, and people are spread out all over the fair. We got horse pulling that's going on, draft horse shows that are going on. I mean, a lot of different events for different interests.
Well, we got a tip that coming up in just a couple of minutes here as we air this live during the noon hour, you've got the little kitties, the 3-year-olds, showing their calves. That must be a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, that's great to see. You know, the next generation working their way up through that. You know, that's going to be coming to the fair. That's always a treat watching the Pee-wee show.
You know, my understanding is that the Addison County Fair is the largest agricultural fair in a state that's kind of full of agricultural fairs. So what does that actually mean?
Well, I mean, it's kind of based on the number of entrants animals. I mean, we had, just the first half of the week, our dairy animals, there was around 250 head here showing. We've got another 110 animals in the 4-H barn. Over 250 head of sheep. We got probably 100 entrants in the poultry barn. And then the horse, I don't have a good number on that, but I know our stalls are full down there, so it's got to be over 300 horses here.
Wow, and you mentioned the poultry barn has 100 entrants, but the poultry barn must be one of those in the children's barnyard where it's hard to count the number of animals because there are a lot of chicks born during the fair.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Your board is all volunteer, so how do you pull this all together?
We have a great team, and so there's 12 of us on the board, and everybody kind of, well, it's like any board. Everybody has their strengths and different areas that they work to, and it just all melds and kind of like magic, I guess. It kind of comes together with a little bit of direction.
So how much work is it for you during the rest of the year? I mean, is it something that you can kind of just lay low on, and then at the end, right before it starts, you ramp up, or is this busy?
Absolutely not. We plan year-round. I mean, we have a business manager that helps us out tremendously as far as, like, getting entertainment, trying to keep us organized. It's kind of the central contact point. And so we negotiate contracts, keep the fair growing. You know, we've spent probably the past 12 years quite a capital expenditures creating, you know, all the way from new forestry buildings to new bathrooms, you know, to improve the ground all the way to, you know, drainage and stuff like that. So when we get our traditional Addison County rains, why, people can still come to the fair and not sink to their knees.
I don't know. I've seen some pretty muddy Addison County fairs.
Well, yeah. I mean, we always, that's a tradition, you know, so we always got to have a little rain so, you know, everybody can take a little bit of Addison County Fair home with them.
You may be a volunteer, but when you're working on those contracts, you're hiring companies, obviously, to do the concessions, to run the midway rides. How do you make sure that you're hiring a reputable company? I mean, are you looking at what they pay their workers and their safety record?
We look at that. Like, we have a long-term relationship with, like, let's say, for example, the carnival that we use, Dreamland Amusements, and they've done a fabulous job for us. So, just like kind of the fairs, generational. Some of our vendors here have been with us from almost the get-go. Our cotton candy vendors, you know, we kind of look at them. You talk with other fairs, you know, you get a sense of who they are and what they are, and just kind of go from there. And if you got a bad egg, why, they end up getting weeded out. So this is a very, very family-friendly fair that just has a lot of community to it.
We got a note from Keely in Bristol who says, "Oh my gosh, I love Addison County Fair and Field Days. I grew up showing cattle and working in the 4-H food booth. It's filled with such wonderful memories that I can't count them all. This year, I was able to enjoy the Field Days with a very dear friend of many years. In fact, the fair was part of our end-of-summer ritual when we were young girls. Last night, she returned after a 35-year hiatus from the fair. She was visiting from North Carolina, and she introduced her husband to his first demolition derby. He's hooked, and they're planning next year's vacation around the fair. We ate fried dough and ice cream and cheered and laughed. The best thing about the fair is old friends," says Keely. Thank you so much, Keely, for that note. And Jim, before we let you go, maybe you could talk a little bit for people. You know, a lot of people visit the fairs, but some of the people who are showing animals or have an interest in the fair are staying over in RVs or camping out. What's it like at night, overnight at the fair?
It actually quiets down. I mean, I'm actually involved in setting up the camping, and so we get a lot of requests, you know, this 4-H group wants to be next to this person or this group, you know, because they come, it's a social event, and so, you know, you'll have some socialization going on around their camping areas or whatever, but around 11, 12 o'clock at night, you know, the fair really quiets down, it's real peaceful, and it's the calm of the day, I guess, after all the hustle and bustle. And then they're fired up and going. You know, the people that are showing, they're up 5, 6 o'clock in the morning getting their animals ready.
Yeah, those animals don't take a sleep in, I imagine, even though they're at the fair.
No, it's actually, you know, it's a lot of work for people to bring their animals here to the fair, and, you know, and we appreciate it because they're a huge part of the fair, and you know, and we understand that it's a lot of effort. You know, you got some fairs that don't have the population of agriculture as we do, and so they struggle to get animals at their fair, where we usually have to figure out how we're going to fit them all in.
Jim Foster is the president of the Addison County Fair and Field Days, which is going on in New Haven through tomorrow. Jim, thanks for telling us about it.
Yeah, thanks for calling me, Jane. It's been a pleasure.
We're talking about fairs today. Addison County Fair already ongoing. Lots more fairs still to come this season. And if you want to share your fair stories with us or your favorite thing about going to the fair, whether you pass it down through the generations, whether it's something that you do just for fun with your friends, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts at vpr.net. Now, perhaps the most grandly named fair of the year is, of course, the Tunbridge World's Fair, which has been going on for nearly 150 years now. Euclid Farnham is on the board of the Tunbridge World's Fair, and he joins us now. Hi, Euclid. Nice to talk with you again.
Well, thank you very much for calling.
So I understand that at the World's Fair, you pride yourselves on being a little bit behind the times.
We do. That's really our motto, and it works for us. It would not work for every fair, but it does for us. And of course, Antique Hill is one of the reasons for that.
We have Antique Hill,
fantastic antique museum, both for farm implements and also indoor things. And it's older people especially like to come and reminisce about that.
What are some of the equipment that people might see at Antique Hill?
Our oldest thing. Well, we have an 1897 steam car in there for one thing. We have a 1600. I'm serious about this. Phaeton, that is the oldest item in our collection. So it goes back.
What's a phaeton?
Long ways.
What is a phaeton?
A phaeton, it's a two-seater, most people would call it a buggy, four wheels, of course, and there are two seats. One is for your driver. By the way, the Queen of England has one that's very similar to this. So two people ride in it and a driver in the front.
Now, I would never go so far as to call the people who are working at the fair antiques, but you do get people who are dressed in period clothing at Antique Hill, don't you?
We do. Everybody is dressed in period clothing, and it depends on what area you're in. We have a colonial kitchen, for example, where they cook over an open fireplace, and these people are dressed in colonial costumes, and you may find somebody in Victorian if it's at a Victorian living room or something. So the costuming varies from area to area, but it's appropriate to the time period.
Do visitors from out of town or out of state ever get confused by the World's Fair reference and sort of stand there scratching their heads going, this is a World's Fair?
All the time. That is the number one question. I've been answering this question for almost 50 years. And it's a question that's over and over again. And if you like, I'll give you the story where this came from.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the very early fairs, in fact, all of the early fairs, one of the main events, and this sounds out of reason today, nobody would have the patience, but it was a political speech by a well-known Vermont politician. And so the fair in the 1870s, this is 1870s, invited the lieutenant governor of Vermont to come down and give a speech. And he gave a good two-hour speech, which must have bored everybody to death. But anyway, during the speech, he referred to the fair as a little World's Fair. So the directors at the time pounced on this and said, you know, this is kind of neat. Maybe we ought to adopt this. So they changed it to World's Fair and dropped the little, and that's what we've been ever since.
So somebody has to stand at the gate saying, yes, this is
exactly
the World's Fair. Are you ever going to retire, Euclid? You were president of the fair for more than 30 years. You're still on the board.
I was president 31 years. I'm retired. I'm still on the board. And believe it or not, I'm the treasurer now. So the workload doesn't seem to go away. Although I'm very happy not to be president. We have a younger man now who's president doing a great job. And there's a lot of stress involved leading up to the fair. So I'm relieved of that now.
What do you like the best about it? Why are you still so involved?
Well, I'm partial to Antique Hill. I now work for my wife, who is in charge of the museum. And so she schedules all the people that are there demonstrating. And so I might be in the post office for a while, or I might be in the store, or I might be in the schoolhouse. So she schedules me all over the place. So I'm actually not running anything. I'm under my boss now.
So you're like the Where's Waldo of the Tunbridge World's Fair.
I do. it gives you an atmosphere of the way things used to be. And again, a lot of older people and kids too really appreciate. We have something in Tunbridge called Youth Day on the first day of the fair, and we invite some 75 schools in the area, in both in Vermont and close and along the river in New Hampshire, and they will send several thousand kids on that first day to our fair, and everything is free for the kids and their chaperones, and it is an absolute zoo on Thursday morning, the day of Ag Education Day. And what we do is put on a series of ag-related events, because unfortunately today you ask the average second grader where milk comes from, he'll tell you the supermarket. And so we have milking demonstrations, horseshoeing decorations, butter making, horse demonstrations, on and on. So kids today can get a little bit of an idea of what life used to be 100 years ago.
Euclid Farnham is on the board of the Tunbridge World's Fair. This year, the fair runs from September 11th through the 14th. Euclid, thanks very much for talking with us about it.
You are very welcome.
We're talking about fairs. We'd love to have you share your favorite story about going to the fair as a kid, or maybe taking your own kids with you. And you can tell us what your local fair is, why you think it's still valuable in this day and age. What is with the agricultural fairs? Is there something valuable still about being able to walk through the children's barnyard, being able to see people showing their animals? What does that mean to you, and how is it a part of our community? You can share your story again. Go to vpr.net or click on Vermont Edition, or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition, and we are spending the day at the fair today, getting sick on the rides, wandering through the animal barns, and checking out the demo derby. Let me know what your favorite part of the fair is. Mine is definitely the animals. I have always loved going through the barns, and even as a non-child, I spend a lot of time in the children's barnyard. I love watching the chicks hatch. I love looking at all of the little baby animals. It definitely is a big draw for me. Maybe for you, it's the maple cotton candy, the one day a year where you say, to heck with the diet, I'm just going to eat what I want. Or maybe you like the demonstrations of antique machinery and modern machinery. A lot of people I see wandering around looking at the new tractors, maybe dreaming about having one of those for themselves. Anyway, you can let us know what your favorite part of the fair is by calling 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or on our Facebook page. We asked people what they love. Michelle loves maple cotton candy. Kathy loves the animals and the food. Maureen loves the maple shake. A lot of maple here. Stephen loves the fried bread dough. And Amanda just loves watching people. Boy, it is good people watching at the fair. Let's turn now to Chris Ashby, who's director of marketing and communications for the Champlain Valley Fair. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having us.
So you're getting ready here. The Champlain Valley Fair runs from August 22nd through the 31st. And what's happening now as you get prepared for the last push before the fair starts?
Oh, there's just hundreds of final details that have to be tied up and, you know, make sure everybody has their credentials to get in for all the different performances we have and all the different vendors we have. Tents are starting to go up. Rides should start showing up soon. As you can imagine, this place is a little bit crazy right about now.
You, I understand, are the biggest fair in the state, and you must be one of the longest as well at 10 days.
We are. And it hasn't always been that way. We've added days over the years, and actually, in fact, this year we moved the days back a day. So we used to run from Saturday to Monday, and this year we're actually running from Friday to Sunday.
Why?
Monday was always sort of a half day. We closed at 7 o'clock instead of staying open late, and we found that it wasn't a very well-attended day and always felt like half a day. Some of the vendors would start closing a little bit early, and it just never quite felt complete. The other challenge was that during the school year. You know, school has just started for kids, and a lot of families were sort of getting ready to send their kids back to school the next day and sort of trying to get back into their normal routine. So we really thought that Friday night, where we weren't open, would be a more friendly day for families to get here, a little more accessible, and we'd be able to have a more complete feeling day that way.
That's right. This year, I guess you'll be ending just before Labor Day.
Correct. We'll end the Sunday night just before Labor Day with a big concert on Sunday night, so it'll really feel like a full day. And then Monday, we can actually let everybody pack up and head home.
So who's the concert?
On that Sunday night, it is Hunter Hayes. He's a young country star who's up and coming and is an incredibly talented young man. And he's opened by a group called Love and Theft, which are an up-and-coming country star.
You also have performers like the Goo Goo Dolls and Daughtry, who people may have heard of this year at the fair. What's the main draw? Is it the big acts that you pull in, the grandstand, or something else?
Well, the grandstand is certainly a significant draw, both for the concerts and for the different motorsports and shows that we do in there. But it's like the other fairs that you've been speaking with. I was listening in, and you know, a lot of people come for the food. You've seen comments about maple creamies and maple milkshakes, and that's one of the most busy places on our grounds is the Maple Sugar Shack. So everybody comes to the fair for different things. Some people come to shop, some people come to eat, some people come for the concerts. There's certainly a big draw, but I wouldn't say they're exclusively the biggest thing we do.
Well, how do you then figure out what your role is? I mean, you are the biggest fair in the state. There are, we heard from the Addison County Fair and Field Days earlier that they're technically the biggest agricultural fair. So how do all of the fairs in Vermont differentiate themselves from one another, or do you not care?
We're similar in probably more ways than we're different, but we all do have slightly different feels to it, if you will. I'm not sure they're intentionally, you know, we don't sit around and go, okay, we're going to rebrand ourselves to establish ourselves differently from somebody like Tunbridge, who does a phenomenal job, but we all have sort of niches. Tunbridge has that sort of antique fair feel. They really have the very traditional fair, and Addison does an amazing job with all their animals. Being in a little more urban environment than they are down in Addison, we tend to be a little bit more oriented towards that, although we really are emphasizing as much as we can the animals, because I agree with what the gentleman from Tunbridge said, how there is a disconnect somewhat between people and where their food comes from at this point. So we're trying to also, you know, bring that back to people. Fairs started, you know, long ago as sort of trade shows for farmers. And over the years, particularly with ours, we've migrated away from that somewhat. And we're now sort of thinking that, you know, we sort of need to get back there, not so much for the farmers, but just for the general public.
Although we should say also the Champlain Valley Expo does have the farm show every year.
It does, which is an amazing event. And that's a lot of fun to walk through because you can see people who aren't familiar with farms just oohing and aahing over the technology that is now on farms.
So I want to ask you, Chris, about some of the other competitions, like the tractor pulls. Are those big competition at a place like the Champlain Valley Fair? Are you seeing people really working hard to try to win that?
Absolutely. We partnered with the Vermont Tractor Pullers Association last year for the first time in a while to bring Vermont people who really do work very, very hard to build these machines and travel around and spend a lot of time and effort, you know, put into that competition. So we wanted those people to have a chance to show off at the biggest fair in the state. So, yeah, there really is both there, and even things with the Demo Derby, which is, you know, entry-level racing for the most part, people put a lot of effort in, and we've had some really fun things. I mean, the Demo Derby, we have a best paint contest, and it's not, okay, this car looks like it just rolled out of the showroom. It's like, who can have the most fun with their paint? So we've had SpongeBob cars, and we've had M&M cars, and, you know, the crowd gets into it and picks a favorite paint scheme and roots for that car for the whole night. So people put a lot of effort into these things, and it really is, they're quite rewarding to see them do that and to see them compete and enjoy it the way they do.
There's kind of an irony, isn't there, to having the best car in the Demo Derby?
Yes, there is. And it, honestly, it's just, it really is, for me, and I know for a lot of our staff, the joy of seeing people really have as much fun as they do at our event, and I'm sure this is true with other fairs, is really why we do it. It's just amazing to see how people really enjoy the fair and how much love they have for the fair after coming here, you know, all their lives.
Okay, Chris, but tell me the truth. How much puke do you have to clean up from the rides on the Midway?
Not as much as you'd imagine. Not as much as you'd imagine. But yes, there's definitely some of those rides. Yeah, you can't get me on them anymore. Might have gone when I was younger, but not anymore.
Do you think the fair still resonates with people, really, though? I mean, you're talking about a disconnect with farming in some cases. And, you know, do you think that fairs in this age of so much technology, so many other activities, still resonate with families?
I think they resonate in a different way than they did originally. I think now they resonate more with those families who want to have the connection to local food and not want to understand what organic food means and why all that's important. I also think there's a piece that's important to them to find out, like, I'm not from Vermont, so some of Vermont's history and understanding of Vermont's farming history in particular wasn't familiar to me until I started in the fair business. And I think there is a thirst for that knowledge to understand what Vermont used to look like and that, you know, 100 years ago it was almost deforested with farms. So I think there's opportunities there for all the fairs to take advantage of and really bring that information to people.
Chris Ashby is the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Champlain Valley Fair. The Champlain Valley Fair runs this year from August 22nd through the 31st. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
So that's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, actually I guess it is the biggest fair in Vermont. But let's turn finally today to the official state fair. Don Chaffee is president of the Rutland County Agricultural Society, which runs the Vermont State Fair. Don, nice to have you on the program.
It's great to be with you.
Why is your fair the official state fair?
Well, I would like to say because it's the best, but then I would be telling a little lie. It was the designation that was given, and we applied for it way back when, and it was given to us. So we relish it with pride, and it's a big responsibility to carry the name of the Vermont State Fair.
So, you say way back when. Do you have a sense of when it, how long it has been the state fair?
No, I don't, as a matter of fact, know exactly when it was designated, but I know that our fair is the oldest fair in the state and one of the oldest fairs in the country. It was started in 1846. Obviously, it had a much different flavor back then when all agricultural, mostly, and goods and services and animals were paraded right down the street in the carts to the fairgrounds, which was called the Rutland Park at the time, which is now our present fairgrounds.
You mean the Demo Derby, not such a big draw in the 1840s?
Not unless it was with two horse carts coming down a hill and not being able to control each other.
The state fair has had some pretty big financial problems that have been revealed in the last several months. My understanding is that you're running about a $200,000 deficit right now, which includes some back taxes to the IRS. And the fair board removed Richard Rivers, who was the president and fair manager. What can you tell me about the finances and state of the fair right now?
Well, right now, the deficit is slightly over $100,000, and we've managed to pay off over half. Obviously, it was 200 plus, and it's been a fairly difficult struggle. But with a volunteer board and the kind of enthusiasm that you heard in Chris's voice is in mine as well. There are people that just are not. We're committed to not letting a proud tradition like this fade, and everybody's pulled their weight. It takes a lot more horses than just one to pull this kind of a carriage. So our planning is well underway, as Chris is, for a spectacular and outstanding fair again this year.
And, yeah, the fair starts on August 29th. And Don, what's your plan to get the fair back in the black and get the IRS paid, all of the contracts paid, and from previous years and then now?
Well, the IRS, we're on a schedule, and we're very thankful to them for, you know, providing us the opportunity to work out a payment schedule with them. And we have met all of 2012's obligations now, and we're cutting into 13. And when we run a successful fair this year, which we are, obviously our age payables will come first. And if we have to go to a net zero operation in order to pay our bills, that's exactly what we'll do. But how do you do it? You get better, you get smarter, you cut some corners, you change some things, you institute organizational changes that will allow for more profit and less waste. You just have to be a smart businessman.
Don, I understand this year you've decided to shake up a couple of things at the fair, including the last day, and you're going to be putting a big concert on the last day of the fair this year. It's a benefit concert. What's the big deal about this concert?
Well, the big deal about it is that the governor, Governor Shumlin, was way ahead of the curve in identifying the opiate addiction problem, and he was very forthright in addressing that in the state of the state message, and it took a lot of guts to do that. We share that view of this being a community problem and not just an opiate problem, and Project Vision in Rutland as well, by Mayor Loris and Chief Baker. We felt that we should do some some small part that we could to help in this particular issue of rehabilitation and aftercare for opiate-addicted individuals, because it's a community problem. So together with some great promoters, Joey Leone is one, and Steve DeClue is another, we're putting on a benefit concert the last day, and it's going to be a fantastic event. We hope to fill the stands from all over the state. We have four major entertainers. Joey Leone's one. Bo Thayer and the Perfect Train Wreck is another. He's a great bluegrass entertainer, one of the best in Vermont. Joey Leone's probably one of the top 10 or 12, depends on whether you ask him or somebody else, guitarists in the country. Hmm. He's on a par with Joe Perry and is a great entertainer himself. We've got Ashley Bouchart out of Nashville, the Ashley Bouchart Band, and Jeremy Graham, the Jeremy Graham Band out of Nashville as well. Those are all donated acts, and then we have an a cappella group of 50 singers who are all Alcoholics Anonymous. They're all recovering alcoholics, and they're fantastic.
Wow. So it sounds like, Don, you're going to have a lot of music, a lot of sort of activity and passion here as we go on this last day of the fair this year.
Well, we're changing it. I'm trying to change the theme, trying to change the attitude, and I'm trying to change the flavor of what the Vermont State Fair means both to the state and to the local community as a participating member. And the governor has been tremendous in his support. It's Governor's Day at the fair. We always designate one day as Governor's Day, and he's coming and he's going to present an award to the 4-H recipient. The outstanding 4-H'er of the year is given an award, and the governor will present that. He's going to kick off the concert. It'll be underway, but he'll be kicking off a major part of it.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a fantastic event and way to charge up the last day of the fair. Don Chaffee is the president of the Rutland County Agricultural Society, which runs the Vermont State Fair. Don, thank you very much for talking with us. Best of luck.
Thank you very much.
We have been talking about fairs today. Listeners, you can still share your fair stories with us. Go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. You can see some fair photos and add your own and tell us about why you love the fair. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about impeachment. It's the 40th anniversary of the resignation of Richard Nixon, who was facing impeachment if he stayed in office. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. 40 years ago today, Richard Nixon became the first American president to resign his post. Had Nixon not resigned, he almost assuredly would have been impeached. Two U.S. presidents have met that fate, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton. Here to provide a history and civics lesson on impeachment is Kenneth Davis, author of the popular Don't Know Much About series. Ken, nice to talk with you again.
It is always a pleasure, Jane. Jane, thanks for having me again on a very memorable day for those of us over 40.
Yeah, I wasn't alive then, so not a memorable day for me, I'm afraid, but memorable certainly piece of American history. But I want to go even farther back here. So both Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton were impeached by the House of Representatives, and then they were both later acquitted by the Senate. So explain how that process works.
Okay, it's equivalent in a sense to the indictment process in criminal trials. In other words, someone's indicted for a crime. That just means they're charged. It doesn't mean they have been proven guilty. We assume innocence in America. In the case of a president or other federal officials, including Supreme Court justices or cabinet members, the impeachment is the equivalent of an indictment. Then the trial doesn't go to a jury of one's peers, but to the Senate. This was all debated very, very carefully back in 1787 because Benjamin Franklin said, if we don't have some way to get rid of a corrupt or incompetent executive, the only choice will be assassination. So they turned to this idea, which comes from ancient British law, of impeachment, of removing a minister or a king's advisor, and they carried it over. And there was considerable debate about who should actually do the trial, who should listen to the evidence. As it turned out, they decided that the House of Representatives would have the ability to issue the articles of impeachment, the equivalent of the indictment, but that the trial would be held in the Senate. And there it would be required, while a simple majority of the House would be required to impeach, a two-thirds majority would be required to actually convict the president and then remove him from office or any other official.
Yeah, you mentioned it's not just the president. Supreme Court justices, for example, who serve for life. So there's not a great way to get rid of them other than impeachment. They can also be impeached.
That's correct. And the very first impeachment in American history was of a Supreme Court justice back in 1805. His name was Samuel Chase. It really had to do with, like all impeachments almost throughout American history, it was really much more politically motivated than a specific high crime or misdemeanor. And we can talk about that phrase, which is in the Constitution. So Samuel Chase was impeached by the House, but also acquitted in the Senate. The extraordinary moment in American history where he was tried included the fact that Aaron Burr was the sitting vice president, and so he presided over the trial. Aaron Burr, this is in 1805, had recently killed Alexander Hamilton. So imagine that scenario. The vice president kills the former secretary of the Treasury in a duel and then goes down to back to Washington to sit on the first impeachment trial in American history. Truth is far stranger than fiction.
Ken, what did Andrew Johnson do that led to his impeachment in 1868?
Once again, a very political controversy. Andrew Johnson, of course, had succeeded Abraham Lincoln. He had been his vice president and became president when Lincoln was assassinated. He had removed from the cabinet the war secretary, Lincoln's war secretary, and the Senate, which was very powerful at the time, especially a group of senators known as the Radical Republicans, were not happy with Andrew Johnson's decision to do that, nor were they happy with the way he was handling the presidency. They thought he was being far too accommodating of the southern states. These were the senators who really wanted to punish the former Confederacy. So there were 11 charges leveled against Andrew Johnson, 11 articles of impeachment. He was acquitted on all of them by a single vote. It was very, very close. Once again, as Gerald Ford said in 1970 when they were considering the impeachment of William O. Douglas, another Supreme Court justice, impeachment is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives decides it is at a given moment in history. The phrase in the Constitution is that officials can be impeached for bribery, treason. Those are fairly self-explanatory, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. And that's where the rub is, because nobody's really ever defined what that means specifically, and the founders left an awful lot of wiggle room with that. The framers of the Constitution left a lot of wiggle room with that phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors.
Just briefly, because I think actually most of us who are listening were alive for Bill Clinton's impeachment. What were his high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, this again related to a policy decision or an actual crime as president, but it related to Bill Clinton's deposition given in a civil suit related to one of the women who had made claims against him. Clinton had given a deposition, and it turned out later that he had, in fact, perjured himself during that deposition. This was considered enough by the Republican House to issue two articles of impeachment. Clinton was, of course, acquitted in the Senate trial by fairly comfortable and bipartisan margins in on both counts. A lot of debate at the time whether perjury in a civil case really rose to the level of the high crimes and misdemeanors that the framers of the Constitution were talking about, and many of those who voted against voted to acquit Bill Clinton, that was part of their justification, that this was not an issue that should rise to the level of impeachment, which is the most power that the Congress has over the president. Of course, the framers of the Constitution were very concerned with balance of power and checks and balances, but this is the ultimate power that Congress has over a president, to actually overrule the decision of the will of the people in electing the president by removing him.
Well, and you know, here we are 40 years to the day from Richard Nixon's resignation, which he would have faced impeachment but didn't because he resigned. And there's been some swirling talk lately about the potential impeachment of President Obama. No one's claiming that. Democrats say House Republicans are considering it. House Republicans say the Democrats are making that up to stir up drama. So just, I mean,
and
I guess,
refunds.
Right, exactly. You know, I guess a yes or no here, Kenneth Davis, is this still a valuable tool, impeachment?
Oh, I think it's ultimately a valuable tool, because Benjamin Franklin was right. If we didn't have any other way to get rid of a president who was truly corrupt or incompetent, I suppose, is a different question, we'd be left with assassination. Richard Nixon, by the way, there were four articles of impeachment drawn up against him. They had been voted by the House Judiciary Committee. A delegation of Republicans went to him and said, your congressional support is gone. And that was the moment at which he decided to resign instead of facing impeachment. Although there were people who, you know, including his family, who said he should fight on. And of course, that's 40 years ago, the first and to date only resignation of a president.
I'm going to have to leave it there, because we're just short on time. But Kenneth Davis, I really appreciate you teaching us a little bit about impeachment, because it's one of those things that swirls around and we don't always know so much about it. So thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Jane. Always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Kenneth Davis is the author of the Don't Know Much About series. All right. Remember scavenger hunts? Well, Louisa Stein is a professor in the Department of Film and Media Culture at Middlebury College. And for the last 4 years, she's been participating in something called the Greatest International Scavenger Hunt the World Has Ever Seen, also called GISHWAS. It involves teams of competitors from around the world who communicate with each other online. Last year, Stein's team, called Vatican Cameos, won the competition. And Louisa is with us now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
So what's the weirdest thing you've ever had to do for the scavenger hunt?
Oh, we do all sorts of weird things in the scavenger hunt. They range from tasks range from the absurd to social action to the seemingly impossible. Things like skydive with a sign that reads, I fell for GISHWAS, or visiting a retirement home and spending time with folks there, sending a military care package, or for this year to be interviewed by NPR and to say your team name, which in my case, as you've said, is Vatican Cameos.
So you mean we're doing you a favor right now?
You are absolutely doing us a favor, and we really appreciate it.
But this is all for a good cause. It's actually for a charity?
It actually does, yes. The proceeds benefit a charity called Random Acts. And the Random Acts supports it, both broader fundraising, raising funds to help, say, aid in Haiti, and also smaller acts of random kindness, like handing out flowers in subway stations.
You know, you said there were some nice things that you've had to do as part of the scavenger hunt, but some of the things are just kind of silly, like make a public service announcement about how we need to prepare for our jellyfish overlord.
Yes, I've been working on that video myself, putting together a PSA for those jellyfish overlords that are going to come because of global warming. The jellyfish will survive. I've also been putting together a remix, romantic, dramatic love scene between Will Shatner and Larry King. That's the one I'm in the middle of right now.
I guess that makes sense for someone who's a professor of film and media culture.
Yes, absolutely. Right up my alley.
Why do you do this, Louisa?
Oh, I do it to be crazy for a week, to push myself out of my comfort zone, to do things I'd never otherwise do, and to connect with my team. It's been amazing to connect with my team. For many years, the first 3 years, we hadn't met in person, and yet we really bonded. And then when we got to go on the winning trip, that was a really special moment to get to know each other in person after having spent all this time working on these crazy things together online.
Yeah, because you have teammates in New York City, Portland, Seattle, Bucharest, Vancouver. And what do you win when you win the competition, which I should say you can't do this year because you're not allowed to win that's, 2 years in a
that's
row?
That's right. They made that rule just to keep us out, I think. but you get an all-expenses-paid trip to a different location each time. So in our case, it was Vancouver. For our trip, we rode on a Viking ship, we flew on a seaplane, and most importantly, we got to spend the time together.
Louisa Stein is competing in the greatest international scavenger hunt the world has ever seen. That's the actual title. I'm not making a judgment call here. The competition ends tonight. Louisa, thank you very much for speaking with us about it. Good luck.
Thanks so much, Jane.
Well, that will wrap up today's show and the week. Monday on the program, spices. Cinnamon is actually the bark from a tree. Imagine walking through a cinnamon forest. Well, Hank Kastner knows just what a cinnamon forest smells like. He spent 33 years buying spices from around the world. He's going to tell us about it next time on the program, and you can send your questions about the world's spices to VermontEdition@vpr.net. Then join us Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.